This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Hey, welcome everybody to the initial, the premiere, the first ever Statman and Robin podcast. Oh man, this is exciting. I am Statman. I'm the excited Statman. Jim Johnson, Statman is not my given name. And here's my co-host.
Holy introductory episode, Statman.
You only get a couple of those an episode, by the way.
Exactly. No, I couldn't resist, you know. Yes. Hello, everyone. I'm Robin Haynes. Robin is my actual first name. I'm going to talk about that a little bit during this podcast. But we're excited to get started with episode number one, as it were. We're going to be focusing mostly on Orioles, Baltimore Colts, Baltimore Bullets, and Maryland Terps, football and basketball history. That's primarily what we're going to be focusing on most of these podcasts. But as we move along, we're definitely some other things and other teams we'll be talking about.
Absolutely. Where do you want to start?
Jim, do you have, we do want to let people maybe get to know us a little bit, in this first and maybe the first few podcasts. So Jim, do you want to get started with a special Baltimore sports, memory for you?
Yeah, and by the way, both of us are freaking delightful. So people are really going to want to get to know us, I'm sure. But yeah, let's start with the Orioles, because I think, that's really the first experiences you and I bonded over, although it took us some years to actually go to an Oriole game together. But speaking of, I think the first one I want to get to is one of my favorite and maybe my favorite Oriole games. And it was August 5th, 1983. Brooks Robinson, Hall of Fame. Ooh. Appreciate. I knew the light of recognition would come pretty quickly with that. Brooks had just gone in the Hall of Fame that previous Sunday. It was a Friday night. Almost 40,000 people at Memorial Stadium, because everybody loved a Brooks Robinson retirement party. And this was, I think, like the third one he had had, and he made light of it himself.
Right.
Fortunately, it was met with a long rain delay. Steady rain that was somewhere around 2 hours, and it didn't stop completely. It was in a light drizzle, I think, when they did the ceremonies, and then they finally started the game. And I still have my scorebook that I kept from that game. I was able to pull that one off the shelf, a little worse for wear, but still perfectly legible. I used to be one of those guys, and, well, you know, stats man, what am I going to do? I came by it naturally. And I point that out because that became significant. It was a pretty nondescript game until the ninth inning. The Orioles were down 5-2, and it was, who was it? Had the leadoff single. Al Bumbrey. They were at the top of the order. And Al Bumbrey hit got a scratch hit to second base and was on with, leadoff hit. And then Disco Danny Ford came up. Crowd was getting a little excited. Boom, he hit into a 4-3 double play. So two out, on. Orioles are down 5-3, and everybody. It was 4-2. I knew they were down by two. Okay, it was 4-2. They were down, and people started going home because the ninth inning had started about 12:50 something that night, and the American League had a curfew rule then. I don't know if they still do, where you couldn't start an inning after 1 o'clock in the morning. And they just squeezed that in. So it was a little after one in the morning where, you know, everybody's like, oh, okay, well, that's it. And then the magic started. The Orioles got five consecutive singles, and the fifth one brought in the winning run. And it was just, and we stayed because we always stay. Even when we probably shouldn't stay, we stayed. We both had to work the next day. We both had to go in on Saturday and work.
Yes. I remember that well.
Yeah, that was not the most productive day I ever had. I'm sure you can say the same. Even though we were young, and I don't want to say young and stupid, but we were still young. And, okay, how well, this isn't fair because I didn't remember this. I remember who got the game-winning hit. How many of the players do you remember in that cycle? I did this to you years ago, and you rattled them off. You rattled off all five hitters in order.
I vaguely remember that. That was a long time ago. Let me see if I can do it. It was definitely Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray, John Lowenstein.
Yep.
And was it Ken Singleton? And then
yes,
Rich Devon got the game winner. Is that it?
You were still okay. Gold. It was 1-5. Yes, indeed.
Definitely falls in the category when my wife hears stuff like that. And yeah. I know it's the same way.
And you can't remember what you're supposed to get at the grocery store. Yeah. Different parts of the memory. You know,
yeah.
There's more data space allotted to one than the other. Just the way we are. So that was an incredible game. And 1983 was an incredible season. It was just so much fun. It was really the peak of the Orioles' magic era from 79 to 83. Obviously, they won a World Series that year. Even if they hadn't won a World Series, it probably would still be my favorite year because they had a lot of fun, strange things happen that year.
They sure did. They sure did. And you want to talk about a strange statistic from that Orioles team that ended up being the world champs?
Yes.
Two different times during the regular season. They lost seven games in a row.
Two, that's right. Yes.
It's kind of hard to believe that that team that would lose seven games twice in a season win the World Series. So.
Now, one of them, I think, was toward the end of the season when they pretty much had the division wrapped up. But still, that's a pretty oddball stat.
Right.
And there's probably a couple other games in that particular season we can cover in later podcasts, but that was definitely my favorite team. And let me add one more thing. My favorite under the radar player was Rich Dowd. Not just because of that game, but he just had a pesky habit of getting the big hits. He wasn't out that great. He was a powerhouse hitter in college, All-American player at Southern Cal when they were a powerhouse team. But he had a streak, an errorless streak. I looked this up and wrote it down recently, and I don't have that in front of me. Let me see. Yeah, 74 consecutive games without an error, which was at that time a record. Might still be. He didn't have a ton of range, but by God, if he hit the ball to him, he caught it.
Yeah, everything that came to him, he got it. Yep.
Yeah. So he was the epitome of a steady player. And I just love that about him. He was probably my favorite under the radar player. How about you?
Well, I'm not going to start off with an under the radar player. I'm going to hold off on that a little bit. So again, if you're talking about Orioles and their glory years, the Orioles and their glory years. You got to talk about Frank Robinson, and he's my all-time favorite Oriole player. And his career, you know, kind of goes without saying just how great he was. And in another podcast, here's a little teaser. One of these podcasts down the road, I really want to get into a deep dive about his career achievements in terms of awards and accomplishments that if you roll it all together, and I'm including as a player and a manager, if you roll it all together, it will never be equaled. So again, that's a little teaser. We'll get into it in a lot more detail. Not today. But Frank Robinson, for me personally, July 28th, 1971, my 13th birthday, and I'm at the game. They're playing the A's, the Oakland A's, who they would meet in the league championship series and defeat them and go on to the World Series for the third year in a row. But that that game on my birthday, Frank Robinson, well, the Orioles were down 2-0 coming into the bottom of the ninth. Really weird thing about that game, the A's scored their two runs in the same inning, I think the fourth or fifth inning, and it was because Brooks Robinson made three errors in one inning.
Yes.
And the A's got those two runs because of that. He made two errors on one play. So everybody's kind of in shock. Can't believe it that Brooks will do that. But the bottom of the ninth, the Orioles are down by two, and Frank usually batted third. And ahead of him, Don Buford and Merv Rettman were batting number one and two, and they both got base hits. Mm-hmm. John Blue Moon Odom was the starting pitcher. They took him out. Frank Robinson's coming up. We got two men on, and they brought in this guy named Raleigh Fingers.
Oh, yeah.
So Hall of Fame reliever there, and one of the first truly great closers.
Yep.
When closers were kind of becoming more of a thing. Anyway, Raleigh Fingers comes in. First pitch, Frank hits it out of the park for a three-run homer. Game over, Orioles win. It's a walk-off. And the little extra tidbit, Reggie Jackson was playing right field for the A's. And my seats were actually kind of a little bit down the right field line. So game's over. The A's leave the field. The Orioles leave the field. Reggie Jackson stood motionless in right field. In other words, you know, he's just dumbfounded by what happened. It was several minutes before he left the field, and it was actually because some of the fans were, you know, really kind of getting on him. Yeah. I do have this vague memory of a Baltimore City cop just kind of strolling out like, "Hey, Reggie, come on. You know, we don't want things to get ugly here." Who knows what he said? But eventually, Reggie did leave the field. But as much as anything, I really, and I've heard Reggie Jackson talk about Frank Robinson and the respect he had for Frank Robinson. I think in a way for Reggie, that was his way of showing some respect that he was just dumbfounded that Frank would end the game like that. So anyway, happened on my 13th birthday. I mean, I can't go wrong with that memory.
Well, and that reminds me, speaking of Frank, also in 1971, Game 6 of the World Series, when he was the winning run at third with one out, and Brooks was up, and he bailed Brooks out again because Brooks hit a shallow fly ball.
Yeah,
I forget if it was center or left field.
Center field, I think.
Okay, and there's Frank, 35 years old, both his legs are hurting him, and somehow he had enough juice to force a high throw the catcher and slide in underneath Manny Sanguian with the winning run. Runs were getting hard to come by for the Orioles in that World Series. And he won game six. They were down 3-2. So he had to win that game to force the game seven. And that was just such a, you know, you don't hear much about his legs. And his legs are pretty well gone at that point. But that's just the kind of player he was. He made the big plays and he sucked it up and channeled his youth for a few seconds and made a pretty good dash in from third to win a game.
Right.
And season deciding game, really.
Right. And if you look at his overall career, you know, if you're not that familiar with him and you want to go back and look him up, you'll see that he only played six seasons in Baltimore.
Right.
But when you win the World Series four out of six seasons, that ain't bad. And that's why
the World Series remembered. Yeah, you get to the World Series four out of six.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's only once since then in all those years afterwards have they gotten to the World Series. So yeah.
Oh, twice. 79 and 83. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
But still. Yeah.
But still a very long time ago.
Yes, it is. Yes. So you got any favorite anything else you wanted to share with the listeners about the Orioles? Because you were a little young to get into the 66 World Championship team, but I know you were into the 1970 team very much, right?
Yes, yes. And I remember the, I don't remember 66 so well. I wish I remembered it a little bit better. Yeah. But 69, I remember really well. And I remember the 69 World Series, watching those games. Really, I remember watching games 3, 4, and 5 in New York, where, you know, the Mets pulled off the big upset. Yeah, I think for any Orioles fan from back in those days, again, I mentioned it before, the glory years.
Right.
I don't know what else to call it.
Well, that's a pretty good way to refer to it. Well, and I, you know, we met, I think it was during the World Series of 1970. It was right around that time that I moved into to your area and met you in the seventh grade.
Okay.
And, so I've never claimed the Oriole, because I was not an Oriole. I grew up a few miles away from RFK Stadium.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, I grew up a Washington fan and got a small dose of the pain that resulted in. And, you know, especially back in the day, although I think there's still some element of that, is Washington and Baltimore just were like, you know, oil and water. You know, they just did not mix very well. So, but then when I, you know, got into essentially Oriole and Baltimore sports territory, I found, hey, this winning thing is pretty fun, you know, and it, great teams to root for. The Orioles, I claimed the Colts championship a few months later because I was there for pretty much the whole season. And after that, and, yeah, it was such a different atmosphere. And of course, you know, the Senators moving out, a year after I moved away from him. So I'm like, well, hey, sorry guys. You know, I guess I was holding you in there. And, you know, then they wound up in Dallas where they've done okay for themselves. But, it was quite a treat, you know, growing up with a winning team. And, I know you recently did a video for the, Baltimore, sports, Babe Ruth Hall of Fame in Baltimore. And, yeah, we can talk about, that whole, that whole backdrop is worth a podcast, the 1970-71 season, which, you know, you're not really going to get any better than that as far as a city and their sports teams.
Yeah. Yeah. 70-71. I mean, you know, Orioles win the series in October of 70. The Baltimore Colts win the Super Bowl in January of 71. And then in April of 71, the Bullets, the Baltimore Bullets, made it to the NBA Finals somehow. and it was, they didn't win the finals, but, you know, to have two reigning champions and a third runner-up in three major sports, very rare for that to happen in major pro sports history. So that was a very special time.
Oh yeah. Well, and that bullet season you're talking about, the shocker was that they went into Madison Square Garden and knocked off the Knicks in game 7 of the Eastern Finals. And that was the only time in that four-year stretch from 70 to 73 that the Knicks did not make the finals. They were the defending champion, and they won it again in 73. So that was, nice to win a championship. But, that was quite an accomplishment, knocking the Knicks out.
Mm-hmm.
It's still viewed as an enormous upset.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back and let's talk about the Colts for a little bit. You grew up a Colts fan, and they were kind of my secondary team for a little while. Then they were my primary team, and back and forth. I always liked that. I never disliked the Colts. But again, that stretch, and we're going to talk a lot 70s and 80s. But for the Colts, probably better off sticking to the 70s. What memories stick out to you, or what players stick out to you from that era of Colts football?
For me, really, more of a golden era for the Colts was after Johnny Unitas was gone.
Right.
And again, I was older. I was in high school, teenager. So the Colts from in 75, 76, and 77, they won the division each year. That was the Burt Jones team. That's really where my best Colts memories are,
yeah,
with those teams. They never managed to even win a single playoff game, unfortunately. So that's one reason they're not as well known in NFL history. But especially that 75 Colts team, a lot of young players. Nobody really knew what to expect. And they actually won their first game and then lost their next four. So everybody's like, here we go again. But a 1-4 start, and they won their next nine games in a row. Only a 14-game season back then.
All right. Yeah, they had no margin for error. They didn't make any. And of course, that next to last game of the season was the vital one, the 10-7 overtime win over the Dolphins at Memorial Stadium. It kind of brought back a little bit of the flavor of the old days.
Yes, yes.
Dragged out game, wasn't it?
Right. Now, if you were around back then, I mean, you remember watching that game. It was played in Baltimore, but in the fog.
Yeah.
Which got worse as the game went on. And I've talked to a few people who were there, and it was sometimes tough to tell what was going on TV and in person, depending on where you were on the field or where the ball was on the field. It was tough to tell what was happening. But another thing about that game, the Colts field goal kicker, a guy named Tony Linhart, he's always going to be known in Baltimore sports history. Not a long field goal at all by today's standards. But again, back in that era of the NFL, nobody thinks about soccer-style kickers, but not all teams had, quote-unquote, soccer-style kickers back then. But most teams were adopting that in their kickers. But today, the field goal that he made would have been considered a chip shot. But back then, even though those soccer-style kickers were generally more accurate, it wasn't a given that he was going to make it.
No, there really weren't givens in the kicking game back then. It's, if you were over, say, 60%, you're probably making the Pro Bowl.
Right.
60% these days, you're cut.
Right. But yeah, it wouldn't be unusual for your kicker to have a game where he misses three out of four field goals, and maybe none of them were over 40 yards. But again, like you just said, Jim, if that happens in today's game, you're looking for work.
Yes.
Unless you're one of the great kickers. But
well, and my favorite Colts memory actually goes back a little bit before yours to 1971. And that was the, I forget if the Colts were playing the Dolphins that game or what, but the famous or infamous, depending on your view, Mike Curtis game, the keep off my turf game. And, you know, Curtis was really my favorite non-Johnny United, because I didn't see, you know, United was well past his prime before I ever saw him. All right. Curtis was just coming into his prime. And, you know, I remember seeing it was Bill Curry say that Curtis was the most unpleasant man to be around on game day.
He just,
yeah. And, you know, a couple of the players, what I'm referring to is a drunk fan ran out on the field to try to steal the ball. And he made the mistake of doing that while the Colts defense was on the field. And Curtis laid him out with a very clean shot. And he got up and staggered, you know, as he was lit. And they later, the guy sued him and it got thrown out of court.
Right.
But a couple of the players were kind of upset. It's like, man, you can't do that to the fans. This is Bill Curry saying this again. And Curtis is like, look, this man violated a city ordinance. I was enforcing it. That was it. How can you not love a guy like that?
Right.
And he was from kind of sort of my neighborhood, Rockville, Maryland, Montgomery County, went to Richard Montgomery High School and all that, and was a fullback. And, you know, Tom Shula would say, yeah, he was a genius to try to have Mike Curtis play fullback, and then figured out he was a linebacker. But he was old school tough with old school attitude and not a big guy, but he could cover territory.
Mm-hmm.
Was outside linebacker, and he could cover the whole field. And then when he met you, it was an unpleasant experience for whoever he hit. Yeah, he was something fierce. And unfortunately, he was one of the men later on that had, no surprise, he had the CTE brain damage. And, you know, but boy, he was a fierce and fun football player to watch, that's for sure. So, okay, we've talked about, I think, where we're going to probably keep a lot of our focus of this show is the Orioles and the Colts, because, you know, they were the much bigger deal. Now, we're definitely going to talk about the Bullets. Hey, they were good and had Hall of Fame players.
They sure did.
Even though they never did draw very well in Baltimore, and you know, wound up you know, in the arena with the Cap Center, and that was the fans could sniff it coming a couple years out, because when Abe Pollin won the expansion franchise for the Capitals hockey team, well, they weren't going to play in Baltimore. So, you know, what was he going to do? There was not a large arena in the D.C. area besides Cole Fieldhouse, and there was no way they were going to play ice hockey there.
Right.
The Bullets, I think, had started playing the occasional weekend game in Cole, and turned out those games at Cole were like a neutral court or an away game, because that's the thing about Washington is, you know, a lot of fans came out from D.C. to see him. And right. A lot of them were the Knicks fans, the Lakers fans, and the Celtics fans that had migrated. You know, the old deal about Washington not being anybody's hometown. It was definitely the deal back in the 70s. But, you know, the Bullets also made a major impact in our sports history. And we went to some of the great games at the Capitol Center that, you know, we'll definitely be podcasting about. And then, of course, the 78 championship. Now you said your opinion was that we should definitely, and you're more directly a Baltimore guy than I am, Rob, so I yield to you. But you think we should keep the Bullets definitely in that mix, even though their time in Baltimore was relatively short.
Yeah, they were, franchise was only in Baltimore for 10 seasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, it did hurt when they moved out of Baltimore. But given the fact that they, you know, just kind of moved down the road and really were not in Washington, they were still in Maryland. And they were, you know, not hard. The Cap Center wasn't hard to get to if you wanted to keep following the Bullets down there. And again, that was the era of indoor and outdoor newly built facilities, the tendency back then was to move them away from the downtown setting and have, you know, easy access to interstate, beltway, what have you. But that trend is certainly over the years. There aren't very many stadiums that are built in that kind of setting anymore.
Now, football stadiums.
Yeah, right.
Or the main, you can put a football stadium, I think, just about anywhere and still draw people. But, yeah, baseball and an arena, yeah, you better be near the city at this point, and it's really a much better idea if you have public transportation.
Right. Well, you know, basketball and baseball, you're talking about a lot of weeknight games. So you need to make it, you know, easily accessible into a downtown area where you can draw people that aren't going to have time to travel to and from.
Right. Now, of course, we're also going to talk about the Terps, because the Terps are kind of the only team that you can really say historically has always been a shared team. Now, the Orioles had a large fanship in Washington after the Senators left, because they marketed there very wisely. And they drew a lot of fans there, and that helped them hit the 2 million mark in the early 80s. But the Terps are they're a little closer to Washington than they are Baltimore, but it's the state's university, you know, that kind of thing. And there's plenty of support for the Terps in Baltimore, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, always has been. And, you know, a great pipeline in terms of players. From Baltimore City, the Baltimore metro area, ending up to playing their college career at Maryland.
Right. So, and a couple in particular that we'll touch on that are real favorites. But yeah, now, of course, we had the national championship, which is kind of out of our date range, but I think we'll probably make an exception for that, because we'll be coming up fairly soon. 25th anniversary of that is next year.
Oh, that's right.
So, I know. So we will definitely have to talk about that. I don't think anybody will begrudge us as we celebrated that night. Oh, my God, I didn't celebrate. So, all right. Well, then, any closing thoughts for our first show? I think we've done this without doing or saying anything stupid, and I'm very proud of that.
Right. Yeah. We think we got over the opening broadcast jitters pretty well.
We got first hit, and we were ready to go. Right.
Right. Yeah. No. I'm excited. This has been awesome. So much more to talk about down the road. We hope everybody keeps giving us a look-see every 2 weeks. So we plan to see you in 2 weeks for our next podcast, and every 2 weeks after that.
That's right. And that's a promise, not a threat, although whatever works, right? All right. Well, that's it for this episode. That was Robin Haynes. I'm the stat man, Jim Johnson. We thank you for listening or watching, and we remind you that it is good to look back as long as you live forward. Take care, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See ya.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sports historynetwork.com. You could be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.